Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz.
So, how did you and Amy meet?
We met on a blind date, and my third year of law school, my father-in-law's best friend, Uncle John, he told me that Amy was moving back to town and I should give her a call.
And was it like, did you click right away?
Amy's version is that she fell in love with me when she opened the door and that I fell in love with her a year later, so... but yeah, we definitely clicked, for sure.
This is Jason Rosenthal. He's a lawyer in Chicago.
I mostly do personal injury litigation, represent the little guy against the big guy.
But many of you might know Jason because of something else. He's the husband of children's book author Amy Krauss Rosenthal. And in March of 2017, Amy wrote an essay for the New York Times Modern Love section that ultimately went viral. The essay was called, You May Want to Marry My Husband.
I've been trying to write this for a while, but the morphine and lack of juicy cheeseburgers, what has it been now, 5 weeks without real food, have drained my energy and interfered with whatever prose prowess remains.
This is actually the voice of actress Deborah Winger. She's reading from Amy's essay, and it was featured on the Modern Love podcast.
Still, I have to stick with it. Because I'm facing a deadline. In this case, a pressing one. I need to say this and say it right while I have A, your attention, and B, a pulse.
Amy wrote this piece while she was battling cancer. The column is a witty, touching, and heartbreaking play on a personal ad for her husband, who she knew she would leave behind.
First, the basics. He's 5'10", 160 pounds, with salt and pepper hair and hazel eyes. The following list of attributes is in no particular order because everything feels important.
Just 10 days after this essay was published, Amy passed away.
I was aware that she had one final project that she wanted to do. And I watched her write this piece as she sat across from me on the couch, working away, taking little micro naps, working away, you know, and repeating that process. And it wasn't until she was completely done with it that she asked me to read it that I knew what it was.
And what did you think when you read it?
I was blown away first and foremost at the writing and her ability to combine what she always did, her whimsy and her humor and how incredibly intelligent she was into this type of piece. And I gave her my full blessing, Guy, not knowing or having any clue whatsoever about what it would become.
Amy's husband, Jason Rosenthal, picks up the story from the TED stage.
There are three words that explain why I am here. They are Amy Krauss Rosenthal. At the end of Amy's life, hyped up on morphine and home in hospice, the New York Times published an article she wrote for the Modern Love column on March 3, 2017. It was read worldwide by over 5 million people. While it was certainly about our life together, the focus of the piece was me. Amy was my wife for half my life. She was my partner in raising three wonderful, now grown children, And really, she was my girl. You know, we were in love, and our love grew stronger up until her last day. Now, my story of grief is only unique in the sense of it being rather public. However, the grieving process itself is not my story alone. Amy gave me permission to move forward, and I'm so grateful for that. Death is such a taboo subject, right? Amy ate her last meal on January 9th, 2017. She somehow lived an additional 2 months without solid food. Her doctors told us we could do hospice at home or in the hospital. He did not tell us that Amy would shrink to half her body weight, that she would never lay with her husband again, and that walking upstairs to our bedroom would soon feel like running a marathon. I want to get a little personal here and tell you that to this date, I have memories of those final weeks that haunt me. I remember walking backwards to the bathroom, assisting Amy with each step. I felt so strong. I'm not such a big guy, but my arms looked and felt so healthy compared to Amy's frail body. That body failed in our house. On March 13th of last year, my wife died of ovarian cancer in our bed. I carried her lifeless body down our stairs, through our dining room and our living room, to a waiting gurney to have her body cremated. I will never get that image out of my head.
You, in your talk, you specifically describe death as it's a taboo topic, especially in the West. Like, we don't like to talk about it. It scares us. But you wanted to be really explicit in your descriptions about what dying is. Can you tell me about why you wanted to do that?
Yeah, I just felt like, you know, well, when I first started to think about really being that explicit, I sort of just warned my family that, you know, this is going to get a little bit raw, and I wanted everyone to understand that. But the reason I did it is because I knew that I could not be alone in having these feelings and living with these images that I do live with even up to now. And that I wanted to take some of that stigma, that taboo out of it, and encourage people to access that and to talk about it. Because it shouldn't be something that we're so very afraid of. If we're ready, I think, if we know what to expect a little bit, I'm hopeful that it won't be as difficult.
So is there a way we can talk about dying without fear and make plans for the inevitable while we still have the time? Can there be beauty even in death? Well, today on the show, we're going to explore those ideas and what it means to prepare for the end of our own life and the lives of those we love, which is ultimately what Amy's essay was trying to do for Jason Rosenthal, trying to prepare him for her death by giving him the space to move on. It's an incredibly beautiful, warm, and also very funny column for the 1.1% of people who don't know it, who might be listening. She says, hey, you know, there's this great guy. He's available. was that just like Amy's way of doing things? Was that just her style?
Oh, man, I don't know. I think, you know, for the most part, that was her way of expressing her love for me. But at the time, I didn't think, oh, wow, you know, I'm going to find someone to love because Amy said I should. But as time has gone by, I just can't explain to you enough how liberating the idea of her giving me that blessing and also, you know, the deeper conversations that we've had has helped me.
I want more time with Jason. I want more time with my children. I want more time sipping martinis at the Green Mill Jazz Club on Thursday nights. But that is not going to happen. I probably have only a few days left being a person on this planet. So why am I doing this? I am wrapping this up on Valentine's Day, and the most genuine, non-vase-oriented gift I can hope for is that the right person reads this, finds Jason, and another love story begins. I'll leave this intentional empty space ahead as a way of giving you two the fresh start you deserve.
In Japanese Zen, there is a term, shoji, which translates as birth-death. There is no separation between life and death, other than a thin line that connects the two. Birth, or the joyous, wonderful, vital parts of life, and death, those things we want to get rid of, are said to be faced equally. In this new life that I find myself in, I am doing my best to embrace this concept as I move forward with grieving.
Do you sort of feel like you hit milestones every, you know, every few months or every few weeks that something changes in a way that you kind of feel and you, I don't know, just visceral?
Yeah, I would say yes. But there's also literal milestones that happen that are incredibly emotional and you just don't know how you're going to get through them. You know, one of the first ones was that my son graduated college. And he'd been doing his best to keep up with his studies while Amy was sick, and he sure did that. And he graduated, and there we were. You know, that was tough. My anniversary, the date of my anniversary, for whatever reason, was much, much more difficult than, you know, Amy's birthday or other occasions. So I think we travel through those spots along the way. But there's always, I think maybe because of Amy, who she was, there's always something that reminds me of us together in our life. And I don't think that's ever going to change.
That's Jason Rosenthal. His late wife, Amy Krauss Rosenthal, wrote an essay called You May Want to Marry My Husband. You can hear Jason's full talk at TED.com. And you can hear more from Amy's essay on the New York Times and WBUR podcast, Modern Love. On the show today, ideas about death, dying, and saying goodbye. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
This message comes from Apple Card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase. That's 3% on products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy.
This message comes from the BBC with Where to Be a Woman. Join hosts Saatchi Kaul and Sophia Smith-Gaylor to find out where in the world women can live their best lives. Search for Where to Be a Woman from BBC Podcasts.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas around how we engage with death. So first of all, Emily, can you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Emily Levine. I am 73 years old and dying, supposedly. It's taking longer than they said it would, which is obviously very good and alternately not so good.
When you were diagnosed, what was the prognosis?
Well, it took a long time to determine what kind of cancer it was, and I asked the oncologist about the prognosis, and he said, if it's lung cancer, a year, and if it's breast cancer, at least 2 years. And I said, well, that's a year is enough. I thought, well, I'll just read books that I read when I was a child that I loved, like The Once and Future King, Alice in Wonderland, and see friends. So I did that for a while, but, you know, I didn't die. And I continued not to die. I haven't been losing weight. For the first time in my life, I get on the scale praying that I haven't lost any weight. So I'm still counting calories. That part's the same, but the hope for the outcome is different.
Now, Emily spent most of her life writing and performing comedy. She calls herself a philosopher comedian. So naturally, she decided she would engage with death using humor. Here's Emily Levine on the TED stage.
I have stage 4 lung cancer. I'm so okay with it. And granted, I have certain advantages. Not everybody can take so cavalier an attitude. I don't have young children. I don't have huge financial stress. My cancer isn't that aggressive. It's kind of like the Democratic leadership. Not convinced it can win. It's basically just sitting there waiting for Goldman Sachs to give it some money. But what if you don't have my advantages? The only advice I can give you is to do what I did. Make friends with reality. You couldn't have a worse relationship with reality than I did. From the get-go, I wasn't even attracted to reality. If they'd had Tinder when I met reality, I would have swiped left and the whole thing would have been over. And reality and I didn't just come to terms with it, I fell in love. I should have known that the moment I fell in love with reality, the rest of the country would decide to go in the opposite direction. So I don't understand, I simply just don't understand the mindset of people who are out to defeat death and overcome death. How do you do that? How do you defeat death without killing off life? It doesn't make sense to me. I don't want to be immortal. I have no interest in having my name live on after me. In fact, I don't want it to. We won't ever be able to know everything or control everything or predict everything. Nature's like a self-driving car. The best we can be is like the old woman in that joke. I don't know if you've heard it. An old woman is driving with her middle-aged daughter in the passenger seat, and the mother goes right through a red light. And the daughter doesn't want to say anything that makes it sound like, you're too old to drive, so she didn't say anything. And then the mother goes through a second red light, and the daughter, as tactfully as possible, says, Mom, are you aware that you just went through two red lights? And the mother says, oh, am I driving?
We humans seem to be obsessed with legacy and memory. I mean, we memorialize everybody who goes, right? In gravestones, yeah. And in foundations, on park benches. We want to be remembered, right? And does that make sense to you, that instinct?
No,
it doesn't.
No. I just read that Florence Nightingale refused to be photographed until Queen Victoria insisted upon it. Because Florence Nightingale said, and I quote, I wish to be forgotten. That makes more sense to me.
Why?
You're going to live on in the memories of your loved ones until there's no one alive to remember you, and then you're done. You're going to be forgotten at some point, whether it's 5 years from now or 50 years from now or 100 years from now, 500 years from now, you're going to be forgotten at some point. Get over it.
Are you like Florence Nightingale? Do you not want to be remembered?
I'm ambivalent about it. I mean, aside from my daughter and my sisters and nieces, et cetera, and my friends. But on the other hand, I care about what I had to say. I think it's important. So I guess I do want that remembered in some way. The thing for me is there's nothing that gives me more pleasure than when someone else takes an idea of mine and makes it his or her own. I want the ideas to have a life and be remembered. I don't care if it's me. I love being in sync with the cyclical rhythms of the universe. That's what's so extraordinary about life. It's a cycle of generation, degeneration, regeneration. I am just a collection of particles that is arranged into this pattern, then will decompose and be available, all of its constituent parts, to nature to reorganize into another pattern. To me, that is so exciting, and it makes me even more grateful to be part of that process. You know, I look at death now from the point of view of a German biologist, Andreas Weber, who looks at it as part of the gift economy. You're given this enormous gift, life. You enrich it as best you can, and then you give it back. And, you know, Auntie Mame said, life is a banquet. Well, I've eaten my fill. I have had an enormous appetite for life. I've consumed life, but in death, I'm going to be consumed. I invite every microbe and a treatiser and a composer to have their fill. I think they'll find me delicious. I do. So the best thing about my attitude, I think, is that it's real. My life has certainly been enriched by other people. Reality comes into being through an interaction. Thank you so much for making my life real. Thank you.
Do you feel like you've done everything you wanted to do?
No, probably. Does anyone?
Yeah. Good point.
But it doesn't disturb me. You know, when the doctor first said it's cancer, my first thought was, oh, I've had a wonderful life. And then I thought, my mother died of cancer when she was 55. And nobody suspected that it was cancer. They performed surgery and opened up her abdomen, thinking there was some kind of blockage, and found ovarian cancer. And when she woke up from the anesthetic, my father told her, and she said, oh, I've had a wonderful life. And I remember over the years, I've wondered whether that was an authentic response or whether she was just trying to make my father feel better, because my father was devastated. So in that moment, I realized, no, it was an authentic response, because it's the response I had. And my second thought was, I've explored as much as I'm going to be able to explore in this lifetime, and I enjoyed exploring it. And now I'll explore death. And my imagination has always been my best friend. Here was a challenge worthy of my imagination. I thought of it as a creative challenge, that everybody dies in a different way, and how was I going to do it?
That's Emily Levine. She's a comedian and a writer. You can see her entire talk at TED.com. Do you think it's possible to die well?
I think it is possible to die well, in the sense that you can take some ownership around how you want your final moments on this earth to be.
This is Michelle Knox. She's a travel blogger who's been to over 90 countries. And Michelle started thinking a lot about death and how to better cope with it a couple of years ago when her dad got sick.
He had a progressive lung disease, and he knew he was dying, and he actually had three very clear wishes that he shared with us as his family. And they were that he wanted to die at home. He wanted to die surrounded by family, and he wanted to die peacefully, so not choking or gasping for air. And fortunately, with modern medicine, we were able to support those wishes. We were able to have him come home, care for him in the home. Then it made it so much easier knowing that everything we did in support of his wishes. And for him, death is still death. There's no getting around that. And there is always going to be a form of suffering at the end for, I think, most people. And we can't pretend that that's not there. But what we can do is allow people to make some decisions around how they want their care to be. If we had these conversations sooner and got it out in the open, things would be a little bit easier.
After her dad passed away, Michelle set out to better understand what a good death can look like. So she started having conversations about death on her travels. She read books on the subject, and she attended nearly a dozen funerals.
So through my learnings over the last 2 years, it's about understanding, okay, I appreciate that one day I am going to die. So if I take a step back while I'm young and while I'm healthy, and I think about things that are important to me and maybe share that with my family and friends, I will have a better chance of experiencing a healthy death at some point in the distant future. And my family will have some idea of you know, what's important to me and how to honor me when I do pass.
I mean, most of us, right, when we're able and healthy, most of us actively avoid thinking about death because death is scary. I think most people would agree that we just don't want to think about it.
That's true. We don't want to think about it. And most people will shut it down if you bring it up. And for quite some time, I've been wondering why, given it's something that impacts every single living being on this planet, is impacted by death at some point. Why have we as societies shut this down and don't talk about it? So I think that's part of the challenge, is that somewhere in there, we've decided that this is a really tough conversation and then we don't know how to talk about ourselves.
Michelle Knox picks up her idea from the TED stage.
So let's get going. Do you know what you want when you die? Do you know how you want to be remembered? Is location important? Do you want to be near the ocean or in the ocean? Do you want a religious service or an informal party? Or do you want to go out with a bang? Literally. In a firework.
All right. Note to self. Talk about my death.
Yes.
Okay, I'm writing this down now.
Okay, good. Excellent.
So what's your perfect death? Like, you know, just kind of sketch it out for me. How do you want to die?
I had my palm read in India recently, and I was told I will live till I'm 86. So I'm okay with that.
All right, okay, 86, pretty good.
And I plan to die in my sleep.
That's like the golden ticket of death.
It is. That's what I'm going for. So the next step is I've let my family know. I have a will, which is very important, and I want to be cremated. I would like a service where I'm honored and remembered. And most importantly, they're drinking French champagne. We'll start with that. There will definitely be some music and potentially a bit of Dancing Queen from ABBA. My honoring of my passing will be a celebration. I would like everyone to leave going, well, she lived her life by her own rules and boy, did she do it well. That's what I hope for.
See, I mean, do you think, like, the rest of us can do that? Like, do you think it's possible to rewire our brains so that, you know, death is like this joyful thing we celebrate? Or, I mean, do you think that just kind of defies, you know, who we are as humans?
No, I think we can redefine this. And I think we're starting to. And I think it's what it really stems from. It's not so much reprogramming the brain, but bringing it more into everyday conversation, acknowledging that death is part of life. And what we should be doing is celebrating the life of someone, particularly if they've lived a long, fulfilling life, and bringing that to the surface and honoring their memory with their life journey.
I've been to 10 funerals in the last year, one of which I helped arrange. They ran the full gamut. A very solemn Greek Orthodox service, full Catholic Requiem masses, and a garden party where I made a toast while scattering my friend's ashes around her garden with a soup ladle. I have carried, kissed, written on, and toasted coffins with a shot of ouzo. I have worn all black, all colour, and a party dress. Despite the vast differences in send-off, despite me being at times out of my comfort zone doing something I've never done before, I drew comfort from one thing, knowing that this is what each person would have wanted.
Through your travels and the people that you've met and encountered, have you come across a culture or a community that just deals with death better than, you know, people in the West, for example, do?
I would say my experience, Buddhist communities really face it head on in a really practical way. And I was actually traveling in Nepal. I was up in the Himalayas. And one night I was spent the whole night awake hearing these horns being blown. And in the morning I was just standing outside in a little piece of sunshine that was shining down on this one spot, when this procession came past me, and part of the procession was a body, and it was a monk who'd passed away during the night. And the village all comes out and walk down, and they go and do the procession after this, honouring the person's passing. And it was quite confronting because it's the first time I'd seen someone who'd passed away. But it was just done with such practical application, I suppose. There's such an acceptance that death is part of life, and there's a way in which it's honoured, that I actually realised probably the fear that we have in the Western culture is this attachment to our human form and the fear of not knowing what happens next. I think across all cultures, we believe one of three things. We either believe we're going somewhere else, somewhere better. We believe we're being reincarnated, or we believe nothing happens and we return to the earth. Hmm. And through all my travels, and I have been to almost about 90 countries now over the years,
wow,
I've not seen anything different than those three possibilities.
Huh.
And even if in different cultures we have different beliefs, I just absolutely know that talking about this topic will enable you to have, to some degree, a good death, however that looks, and also a healthy bereavement. Grief is always going to be grief, and it is part of life, and we will never be able to remove that aspect, but we can remove guilt and fear and stress and anxiety. We can work on those things.
That's travel blogger Michelle Knox. You can see her full talk at TED.com. On the show today, ideas about dying well. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas about dying well, grief, and even how we take care of the dead.
I would be in the crematory about to cremate a body and realize that it was me and this person alone in this industrial warehouse.
This is Caitlin Doty. She's a mortician.
Why was it me? I was some random 25-year-old girl. Why was I the one alone with your father doing this procedure, sending him into the sacred flame for his final moment on Earth? Why was that just me? And why was it in this warehouse? And how did we get to this place? I knew the history, so I knew that people used to take care of their dead from start to finish, from dying process to disposition, burial or cremation. And here we are in the 21st century, and it had become, efficient, sure, but where is the humanity in that?
Did people used to have a healthier attitude about death, like a long time ago?
I would say absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not really in the position to rank people on their or rank cultures or time periods on their levels of acceptance. But I will say, even if you want to look at 150 years ago in America, when someone died, they died at home. The family took care of the body. They were prepared and waked in the home. Some neighbor built a wooden coffin, and the person was carried on the family's shoulders to be buried. And it was entirely interactive and entirely family-based. And in that 150-year time to where we are now, we've completely outsourced every part of the dying and death process. Mm. And of course, it's going to affect our culture. It's going to affect how we see death and how comfortable we are with death. But I think people are starting to realize that maybe that's not the best system.
Caitlin Doty picks up her idea from the TED stage.
In America, our death traditions have come to be chemical embalming, followed by burial at your local cemetery, or more recently, cremation. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and its economic model is based on the principle of protection, sanitation, and beautification of the corpse. Whether they mean to or not, the funeral industry promotes this idea of human exceptionalism. Doesn't matter what it takes, how much it costs, how bad it is for the environment, we're gonna do it because humans are worth it. It ignores the fact that death can be an emotionally messy and complex affair, and that there is beauty in decay. Beauty in the natural return to the earth from whence we came. We'll start with a dead body. The funeral industry will protect your dead body by offering to sell your family a casket made of hardwood or metal with a rubber sealant. At the cemetery on the day of burial, that casket will be lowered into a large concrete or metal vault. When you choose burial at the cemetery, your dead body is not coming anywhere near the dirt that surrounds it. Next, the industry will sanitize your body through embalming, the chemical preservation of the dead. Embalming is a cheat code, providing the illusion that death and then decay are not the natural end for all organic life on this planet. Finally, the industry will beautify the corpse. They'll put it in makeup. They'll put it in a suit. They'll inject dyes so the person looks a little more alive, just resting. Now, if this system of beautification, sanitation, protection doesn't appeal to you, you are not alone. There is a whole wave of people, funeral directors, designers, environmentalists, trying to come up with a more eco-friendly way of death. There's no question that our current methods of death are not particularly sustainable, what with the waste of resources and our reliance on chemicals. Even cremation, which is usually considered the environmentally friendly option, uses, per cremation, the natural gas equivalent of a 500-mile car trip.
So it seems like over several years of being in this industry, you've come to the conclusion that the way we handle bodies, at least in the U.S. and in Western countries, it isn't just misguided, but it's not environmentally sustainable.
Yeah, and so if someone is more environmentally minded during their life, they're going to want a chance to actually go back to the earth. And we now call it natural or green burial, but for thousands of years of human history, they just called it burial because that's what it was. They didn't have all these bells and whistles and protective devices we have now. So a natural burial is simply a hole that's actually much shallower than in a conventional cemetery.
because all of the good decaying mechanisms are in that topsoil. And then you're in just a simple cotton shroud, or you can have a casket that's very decomposable, like a wicker casket, for instance, or a seagrass casket. And you go underneath the ground, and sometimes you can have a headstone, sometimes not. But it's really just, it couldn't be any more simple.
It seems like what you're talking about isn't just a, you know, isn't just a method of being buried, but it's about something bigger, right? That it's almost like a philosophical outlook that we're just, you know, we're just another animal. We're going to die. And like there's a cycle here and we might as well be part of that cycle. Like we might as well become food for other creatures and nutrients.
Yeah, exactly. Like I've taken more than my fair share of things that have hurt the earth. And why am I going to continue to hurt the earth when I die? Even if it's symbolic, why am I not saying I care about stewardship? And something that I'm very excited about is something called conservation burial. And what that is a bit of like natural burial plus, in the sense that it's land that might be developed on otherwise, but once you bury a few bodies there, they can't develop on it.
Ah.
And so a lot of the money for your burial goes to long-term stewardship of this land. And beyond that, they're reintroducing native plants to the land. It becomes a place that's comfortable for, you know, to walk your dog or to come do yoga or meditate. It becomes this communal atmosphere again in the way that that cemeteries used to be.
So instead of these like manicured lawn type cemeteries, you would just kind of find a natural area. And as people get buried there naturally, it becomes kind of, you know, protected conservation land.
Exactly.
There's hope in conservation cemeteries. They offer dedicated green space in both urban and rural areas. They offer a chance to reintroduce native plants and animals to a region. They offer public trails, places for spiritual practice, places for classes and events, places where nature and mourning meet. Most importantly, they offer us, once again, a chance to just decompose in a hole in the ground. The soil, let me tell you, has missed us.
So Caitlin, you actually do some of these conservation burials outside of L.A. in Joshua Tree, right?
Yeah, and I've stood there as someone buried their mother and they just hand fill the grave and the person just disappears into the desert. And you can see them working out their grief as they are shoveling the dirt.
So it's almost like there's a connection between a natural or conservation burial and making death less painful.
I think it's almost kind of a metaphor. The body's under there decomposing and it's messy and it's wild, as your grief is and as it should be. It's supposed to be messy and wild and difficult and a journey. You're not supposed to trap your emotions in a box underground and don't let anything touch it. You're supposed to feel your feelings because that's the only way through death. And I think accepting that that's what's going to happen to your body also helps you accept that that's what's going to happen in your mind and your grief process. People are so afraid to be interested in death. They don't want to seem morbid. But death is the natural end to every single person's life. If you're not going to be interested in death, if that's not the universal experience, what is?
Caitlin Doty, she's a mortician in L.A., where she runs her nonprofit funeral home, Undertaking L.A. You can see her full talk at TED.com. On the show today, ideas about dying well and the lessons we can learn from those who have already died.
I still remember an expression I heard when I was in my teenage years decades ago, where someone said, if you want to learn about man's failures, read the newspaper from the first page onwards. If you want to know about man's successes, read it from the last page.
This is Lux Narayan.
And those were days when the newspaper had just one section and the obituaries were typically towards the end of the paper. And that's essentially what they meant. And I couldn't agree more because, you know, the kind of lives that are celebrated in the obituaries that are written about by an editorial team are typically lives well led.
Ever since Lux was a teenager, he's been fascinated with the way people are memorialized in print.
It kind of paints a rich tapestry of the different kinds of things people do and are remembered for. And I think it's a very beautiful reminder of the kind of legacy people leave and how they made an impact and just the broad canvas that our world is, right?
Here's more from Lex Narayan on the TED Stage.
I read the obituaries almost every day. My wife understandably thinks I'm rather morbid to begin my day with scrambled eggs and a let's see who died today. In my day job, I run a company that focuses on future insights that marketers can derive from past data, a kind of rear-view mirror analysis. And we began to think, what if we held a rear-view mirror to obituaries from the New York Times? Were there lessons on how you could get your obituary featured, even if you aren't around to enjoy it? And so we looked at the data. 2,000 editorial non-paid obituaries over a 20-month period between 2015 and 2016. What did these 2,000 deaths, rather lives, teach us? Let's look at age, the average age at which they achieved things. That number is 37. What that means is you got to wait 37 years before your first significant achievement that you're remembered for, on an average, 44 years later when you die at the age of 81, on an average. Talk about having to be patient. Of course, it varies by profession. If you're a sports star, you'll probably hit your stride in your 20s. And if you're in your 40s, like me, you can join the fun world of politics. Politicians do their first and sometimes only commendable act in their mid-40s.
So, in your talk, you have this beautiful, like, word chart, right? We've seen these before where you've got like small, teeny tiny words and big words to show which words showed up the most in these obituaries. And amazingly, when you show this on screen, there's one word that stands out above all others, and it's help.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
It's amazing.
I was fascinated when I saw that word because when you're analyzing 2,000 paragraphs of text, you wouldn't expect one or two words to stick out and stand out as prominently as this did. And what we found fascinating when we went through some of those descriptors was the fact that the help took on different contexts. For example, Reverend Rick Curry, who, you know, helped veterans and disabled people by running writing and acting workshops. There's Jocelyn Cooper, who was a grassroots organizer in Brooklyn in the 1960s, and she helped pave the way for the first African-American woman to sit in the U.S. Congress. There was someone who passed away a few weeks ago who helped create the character of Spider-Man. It's beautiful that, you know, the people who are remembered for things that they did helped do so many things in the most obvious sense of the word in terms of helping people, but in some not so obvious context as well in terms of helping a discovery, helping a creation, or simply helping explain something. It was beautiful how that word stood out so strongly.
Having read all these obits and having sort of crunched the numbers and just thinking about it, could you argue that in some ways we live a part of our lives, or a big part of our lives, in preparation for death?
I think we do, even if we aren't directly thinking about it. There is certainly a part of us that is cognizant about the passage of time, about the fact that there is less time to do some of those things that we set out to do. And you see that in different ways. You see people crossing a certain age or a certain point in life when they say, okay, I want to actually do those things that I promised I would do 20 years ago. And all of that, even if not articulated in the context of death is rooted in some way realizing the passage of time and therefore preparing for a time when we're not going to be around.
We uncovered many lessons from lives well led and what those people immortalized in print could teach us. The exercise was a fascinating testament to the kaleidoscope that is life, and even more fascinating was the fact that the overwhelming majority of obituaries featured people, famous and non-famous, who did seemingly extraordinary things. They made a positive dent in the fabric of life. They helped. So ask yourselves as you go back to your daily lives, how am I using my talents to help society? Because the most powerful lesson here is, if more people lived their lives trying to be famous in death, the world would be a much better place. Thank you.
Lex Narayan, he runs a social media analysis company called Unmetric. You can find his full talk at TED.com.
I'm gonna live till I die. I'm gonna laugh instead of cry. I'm gonna take the town and turn it upside down. I'm gonna live, live, live until I die.
Hey, thanks for listening to our episode on Dying Well this week. If you want to find out more about who was on it, you can go to ted.npr.org. And to see hundreds more TED Talks, check out the TED app or TED.com. Our production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Janae West, Neva Grant, Rund Abdel Fattah, Casey Herman, Rachel Faulkner, and Deba Motasham, with help from Daniel Shukin and Megan Shellong. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Colin Helms, Anna Phelan, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading right here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology. Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
This election season, you can expect to hear a lot of news, some of it meaningful, much of it not. Give the Up First podcast 15 minutes, sometimes a little less, and we'll help you sort it out, what's going on around the world and at home. 3 stories, 15 minutes, Up First, every day. Listen every morning, wherever you get your podcasts.